Back a couple of years ago, we read a Facebook post where a preacher's wife said that her husband felt like he'd put in 27 hours on a Sunday by the end of the day. So Janae and I get a laugh at that about every week. I say, well, I put in my 27 hours today. I don't feel that way. I'll tell you, all the prep work is where the work is. I enjoy studying with saints. I enjoy proclaiming the truth of the gospel of Christ. But I think Trevor just added 2 hours to today's by leading the new song right before I get up. So now I've had 29 hours in today. We're going to continue our study on Daniel, the prophet Daniel, except our focus is going to be a little different than our 9 o'clock service. I'm going to look at Daniel as God's prophet to foreign kings. God sent a lot of prophets to prophesy to the Israelites or to the southern kingdom of Judah, to God's people, in order to try to encourage them to repent of their sins and return to him and to become faithful to him. Daniel is kind of unique in that regard. His entire life's work was mainly to prophesy to foreign kings. Even Ezekiel was a contemporary of Daniel's. Ezekiel was even in Babylon, but he was out by the riverside with the people of God, mourning with them over their exile, prophesying to the people of God. Daniel was prophesying more to pagan kings during his career. This morning, we talked about the fact that Nebuchadnezzar, who came to power in Babylon in 605, had a busy year that year. In 605, he defeated Egypt. His father, Nabopolassar, died, and he became king of Babylon. And he besieged Jerusalem that year and took some articles from the temple. And that's when he brought Daniel and Hananiah and Mishael and Azariah up to Babylon. They were sort of the cream of the crop, if you will. They were from royal families and noble families. They were intelligent young men. They were good looking. And they were just the kind of men that Nebuchadnezzar wanted to run through his training program to prepare them to serve in his court and to serve him. In Daniel's lifetime, he witnessed the end of the Assyrian Empire all through and prophesied all through the Babylonian Empire and continued his work on into the beginning of the Empire of the Medes and the Persians. We looked at a little bit of a timeline this morning to show kind of where that fit into this overall scheme of the exile of the people of Judah in Babylon. We said he was good-looking, intelligent, educated, understanding and discerning in knowledge, just the kind of young men who could do well and could learn about the literature and the language of the Chaldeans in this 3-year training program. We talked about the hiccup that came up. They were expected to eat everything the king ate, and it was really a blessing. The Babylonians thought they were doing these young men a favor. They were eating the best of the best, just like the king would. The problem was there were things the Babylonians ate that were not allowable under the dietary restrictions of the Jews, and Daniel had already purposed in his heart that he was not going to defile himself, and so he came up with that compromise. He came up with that little test with Ashpenaz, who was their handler, and he allowed them 10 days to eat only vegetables and drink water, and at the end of the 10 days, those 4 from Judah were healthier, more robust than all of the other trainees, and so what could have been a big conflict became a non-issue. We looked this morning in our Bible class. We talked about some of this, and we talked about Nebuchadnezzar's dream that he had in his second year of his reign, and the fact that he expected his wise men to give him not only the interpretation of the dream, but to tell him what he dreamed so that he would know. If somebody can tell me what I know I dreamed and I haven't told them, somebody that has the ability to know my dreams gave that information to them, therefore I can trust the interpretation was his intent. And these men, almost his wise men and sorcerers, almost lost their lives over their inability to tell him what he needed to know until Daniel stepped in. And Daniel made it clear, this is not me who's giving you the interpretation. This is the one true God of heaven that has told me your dream and the interpretation of it. And of course, he saw that statue with the golden head and the silver chest and arms and the bronze belly and thighs, the legs of iron and the feet of iron and clay mixed, that stone that was cut out without hands that rolled down the mountain, struck that statue on the feet and destroyed it. And, of course, he told him, you're the head of gold. These other sections are other world empires that are going to come along after you. And that kingdom of iron is going to be strong as iron, but it's going to be a mixed kingdom. It's going to be a divided kingdom, and that's going to introduce some weakness and some brittleness into it. And this kingdom that God, this stone represented, this kingdom that the God of heaven is going to establish in the days of those kings, and it's a kingdom that will never be destroyed. Well, of course, Nebuchadnezzar knew that he'd gotten the right interpretation because Daniel could tell him what the dream was. And so Nebuchadnezzar said, your God is a God of gods and a Lord of kings and a revealer of mysteries. And of course, he granted him many gifts and he promoted him to be the ruler over the whole province of Babylon and to be the chief prefect over the wise men of Babylon. And of course, in turn, Daniel promoted his three friends to be administrators in that government. And so he's rewarded for his ability to interpret Nebuchadnezzar's dreams. Now, as we go through, you have to consider that Nebuchadnezzar's being exposed to the God of Daniel, the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in spaces and in pieces. And his thinking evolves as he goes through as just who this God is. And at this point, this is a great God. He's a God among many, but he's pretty powerful. He's pretty impressive. He is the revealer of mysteries. Then Nebuchadnezzar had another dream over in Daniel chapter 4. If you read verses 4 through 27, we're not going to do that. But Nebuchadnezzar had this dream about this great tree, and all the birds of the air made its nest in this tree, but the tree was cut down, but a bronze and iron rings were put around to bind up that stump that was left, and later the tree was allowed to grow back. And so he came to Daniel asking him for the interpretation, and Daniel's reaction was, my Lord, if only the dream applied to those who hate you and its interpretation to your adversaries. This is not good news, Nebuchadnezzar. And you can see the devotion that he has, the loyalty that he's showing to this king that he's serving, in spite of the fact that it wasn't by his own choosing. He's in captivity after all. And yet he lets Nebuchadnezzar know that this is not good news. I wish God was prophesying about one of your enemies instead of about you. By this time, Nebuchadnezzar and Daniel had developed a relationship of respect, mutual respect. And so he told Nebuchadnezzar, this tree represents you, and you're going to be chopped down. This stump is going to be banded with iron and bronze, but you're going to share the fields with the beasts of the field for 7 periods of time. We're not sure exactly what that is, whether it was 7 years, but at least it was 7 periods of time of some kind. And then the kingdom is going to be restored after you recognize that it is heaven that rules. Well, Nebuchadnezzar was impressed, but he wasn't impressed enough. 12 months later, he's on his roof and he's walking around, and you know, I guess one of the 7 wonders of the world are the Hanging Gardens of Babylon. I mean, Nebuchadnezzar walking around looking at all the wonderful things. He's on his rooftop of his palace. He's admiring all of the wonderful things that I've been able to accomplish. Look at all the great things I've done by looking around at all the things in the city of Babylon. And that's when God struck him because of his arrogance, because he failed to recognize that the God of heaven is the one true living God. He is in control. The only reason you're on the throne is because God allowed it. And he needed to be taught a lesson. And I guess he appeared to be driven to madness by the other people in the administration of the government. He was driven out. He lived out in the field with the animals. His fingernails began to grow long. His hair grew long. He's eating grass like a cow. I mean, he was out of his mind. And it's because the God of heaven did that to him. And after this 7 periods, whatever it turned out to be, He regained his sanity. He was brought back in. He was reinstated as the king of Babylon. And he has some impressive things to say about the God of heaven at that point. He's learning more and more about just who the Jehovah God really is. Well, we looked at this chart a little earlier, and I think it's helpful. You can see on the chart that Nabopolassar was reigning up until 605. When he died, his son Nebuchadnezzar took over. The same year that Nebuchadnezzar besieged the city of Jerusalem, took the article from the temple and took Daniel and his three friends up and put them in that training program. Daniel prophesied through the entire reign of Nebuchadnezzar. There were three other kings that followed. One, evil Moradoc, is actually mentioned in the scriptures. Apparently he only reigned for about a year. But when he came to power, he took Jehoiachin, the king who had been in prison all this time that Nebuchadnezzar was reigning. He was in prison, and for some reason evil Moradoc took him out of prison, gave him a position of distinction, and treated him with respect. Apparently there were other conquered kings that would sit at this table and eat good food, and they were cared for, given an allowance. They were treated well. And so for the rest of his days, I guess evil Moradoc treated him with respect. Only reigned for about a year, and the next king about 3 years, the next king just a matter of months. And then we have a period where there are two reigning concurrently. And the top dog is Nabonidus, and his son was second in the kingdom, and that's Belshazzar. It is Belshazzar who apparently was given the privilege of acting as king in the province of Babylon, and so he's the one that we see Daniel dealing with. Now, you need to keep in mind, of course, is Belshazzar, who is the last king. He's put to death. The Medes and the Persians take over. After that, keep in mind this dual reigning of Nabonidus and Belshazzar, because it's important to our study. There were other visions that Daniel had. He had a vision of four beasts. This was in the first year of Belshazzar, about 552 BC. Daniel had this vision of these four beasts. And as it turns out, the four beasts were parallel to, in interpretation, parallel to the dream that Nebuchadnezzar had about the statue with the four sections. And so there were going to be these four kingdoms, starting with Babylon on down. And so he has this prophecy, the four beasts, that mirrored that earlier prophecy. Then in the third year of Belshazzar, he had a vision about a ram and a goat. And it's basically about the rise of Alexander the Great and the Greeks with the ram and the goat. There seemed to be that period we saw on the chart. It's almost blacked out. It's like Nebuchadnezzar understood who Daniel was. Nebuchadnezzar took advantage of who Daniel was and his connection with the God of heaven and the things that he knew in his wisdom, because God was with him and helped him. And yet when he's gone, we hear nothing about the kings of Babylon consulting Daniel anymore. And in fact, I know they forgot who he was, because Belshazzar, you recall, decides he's going to have a big party with his friends, and he's going to entertain his friends. And so they go to the storehouse and they bring out these golden goblets and cups and other utensils that had been taken out of the temple of God by Nebuchadnezzar. And they've been in stores all this time. And so he decides, this is perfect. We're going to have these golden cups to drink wine out of. We'll just have a big party. And they're in the midst of this party, and all of a sudden this hand shows up and begins to write on the wall, "Meeni, meeni, tekel, upharsin," and nobody knows what in the world it's talking about. They're beside themselves. We're told that Belshazzar's knees were knocking against each other. Okay, I mean, he's terrified, but he doesn't know what to make of it, and he doesn't know where to go. How do we find out what this is all about? And there's a queen mother or an older woman who's in the royal family who happens to be there, and she says, "I know who you need to call. There's a fellow named Daniel over. He's getting older now. Daniel's still around, and he's the one that prophesied to Nebuchadnezzar during his reign. He can help you. Here was somebody in the palace that actually knew something about Daniel. A lot of people had forgotten about him. And so they bring Daniel in, and Daniel interprets these words that have been written on the wall for him. He said, this is what it means. God has numbered your kingdom and put an end to it. You have been weighed on the scales and found deficient. Your kingdom has been divided and given over to the Medes and Persians. That's what that handwriting means. And he was inclined to believe him because those words didn't show up. It's not like they came in the morning and they happened to be up there and anybody could have done it. They watched this miraculous hand write these letters on. And now here's this prophet of God that tells him that's the message from God. And that's what you have to look forward to. Now, I don't know much about Belshazzar, but I will say one thing to his credit. Sometimes kings are of a mind to, kill the messenger. If bring me a good message and I'll be happy. Bring me bad news and it could be to your demise. I mean, some men were just like that. Not this man. This is not good news, folks. You've been weighed on the scales and found deficient. Your kingdom's been divided and given over to the Medes and the Persians. Your kingdom's done. Bring a robe in. I'm promoting this guy. I'm going to make you number three in the kingdom. Why would he say number three in the kingdom? Well, Nabonidus, my dad's number one. I'm number two. I have no authority but to give you the number three position. It fits secular history as well as what the scriptures have to say. And so he promotes him to third of the kingdom. I guess for the rest of the day. I mean, Belshazzar died that night and the Medes and the Persians took over. And so now we begin to see Daniel interfacing with a man by the name of Darius. And I understand from my studies that it was Darius the Mede. He was he was reigning along with Cyrus the Great, just like Belshazzar had been given the privilege of administering the region of Babylon and the city of Babylon. Darius had been given that same that same privilege by Cyrus the Great. But we have Darius in Babylon with Daniel. And so Darius organizes his government. He's taken over. And so he establishes three commissioners. There's Daniel and two others. Don't know who they were, but two other men along with Daniel were serving as the three commissioners. Then there were these 120 governors or satraps who were under them, who administered the affairs of the government. Well, Daniel began to distinguish himself with Darius, and word got out. The rumors were floating around. Darius is thinking about promoting Daniel to the number one position and putting the rest of us under him. Well, one thing we talked about this morning was worldly ambition, selfish ambition, political ambition. These fellows were selfishly ambitious. The last thing in their mind, what's really good for the nation, is our king doing something that's going to move the nation forward and make the right decisions for the country and so forth. No, they're getting ready to promote Daniel and put him over the top of us, and we're not going to have it. And so the first thing they do is begin to look for some chink in his armor. Okay, we got to tear this guy down in the eyes of Darius if we're going to achieve our objectives and get him torn down and pulled down politically. And so they look, they can't find anything wrong with the guy. He works hard, he's smart, he's wise. When he does it, he's done right. When he makes a decision, it's in the best interest of the nation. He's not running around with his wife. We can't find any moral problems with this guy. What are we going to do? And so they decide to fabricate a conflict between the convictions of Daniel and the laws of the land. That's the only way they can do it. They know he's not going to compromise his convictions. He is such a man of character, they're going to use that against him. That's how low life these fellows were. And so they come up with this scheme. They go to Darius and they trick him into signing a document. They say, just for the next 30 days, you're the king of this great nation and so forth. For the next 30 days, you just sign this decree and nobody can petition any other god or man other than you for the next 30 days. And if they do, you throw them in the lion's den. I mean, that'll just show the people that you're in control. That looks like a good thing to do. Yeah, why not? And he signs it. The last thing he's thinking about is the impact this piece of paper is going to have on my servant Daniel over here, and yet he signs it anyway. Now, in their culture, There was no, hey, I signed that piece of paper last week. Bring it in here. I want to tear it up. I made a mistake. He signed the piece of paper. It's a decree in effect and in order. And for the next 30 days, anybody who makes a petition to any man or god other than Darius the king is going to be thrown in the lion's den. And he tries to find ways around it. There is no way to get around this edict that he was foolish enough to sign. And it looks like the enemies of Daniel have won. This is exactly what they wanted. They're gleefully waving this piece of paper around under Darius's nose and say, you're the king of the Medes and the Persians. You can't back out of this. We've got it in writing. Here's your signature. Here's your seal in the wax. You can't back down on this. And he was beside himself. In fact, he lost sleep over it, trying to find some way to get around this. And there is none. And so they bring Daniel. They throw him in this den of lions. And they cover the opening up. Everybody else goes to bed and sleeps like a baby, not Darius. He doesn't sleep a wink. All night long he's tossing and turning. All night long he's worried sick about his servant Daniel. So he gets up early in the morning, goes out, pulls the cover aside. Daniel, did your God protect you? And he calls out. Everything's fine. Everything's great. Get him out of there. Bring those fellows that tricked me into signing this piece of paper. Brought them and their families, threw them all in. And I'll tell you, this was a miracle of God. This was not, well, they happened to be old, docile lions. It wasn't, well, they'd just been well fed the day before and they weren't that hungry. The very same lions that lay side by side with Daniel all night are the very same ones that begin to tear those bodies apart before they ever hit the floor when they threw them in. Their scheme backfired on them and it was to their demise. There was nothing wrong with Daniel's convictions. There was nothing about his convictions that was detrimental to the nation. They had to fabricate something artificial to create an artificial conflict between the two. Over in chapter 9, we see this prayer by Daniel on behalf of the people. This is the first year of Darius. It's about 538 BC. And then the angel Gabriel actually appears to him and gives this messianic prophecy to Daniel. And then he also has this vision of these detailed conquests between various kings of the earth. If you're foolish enough to get on the internet, there are a lot of great stuff on the internet, okay? But there are liberal theologians out there that have no faith in the inspiration of the scriptures. They just think it's a bunch of writings by a bunch of guys. And there are men who will date the book of Daniel much, much, much later than it was actually written. And they have not a shred of evidence to date it later. Not a shred of evidence to date it later, other than his details of these conflicts between these world leaders is so precise and is so correct of things that happened after Daniel died, wrote these things down and died, that he couldn't possibly know. Somebody that watched these things unfold in history had to sit down and write it down after the fact. That's their only logic for dating it as a later book written by somebody other than Daniel. And what they don't realize is that Daniel was a prophet of God. And God knows the end of a thing before the beginning. And he revealed those things to Daniel. He wrote them down. And hundreds of years later, that's exactly what happened. It's exactly what was written and what came about. And then in chapter 10, Daniel is comforted by an angel of God. This is in the third year of Cyrus. And there's this awesome figure that he sees standing over the river Tigris and there on the banks of the Tigris, and he is awe-inspired. And so he gives Daniel that message that you are held in high esteem with God and that he has heard your prayers. It's a remarkable life by a remarkable man. And I think there are some important things that we need to keep in mind and take with us from a study like this. Here was a man who touched the hearts of the most vicious monarchs the world's ever known. When you look at the accounts of their military exploits and the kind of viciousness with which they slaughtered men, women, children, pregnant women, they had no ice ran through their veins, and yet Daniel touched the hearts of these men because he was a man of integrity. He was a man that showed care and concern for them. Even though he was a captive of theirs, he was a man of such integrity. He took advantage of the opportunities that God afforded him. You think, how bad could it be to be dragged off into Babylonian captivity, and yet he kept his head, he remained faithful to God, never compromised his principles, and yet there were opportunities, there were doors that were opened to him, and he took advantage of those. His personal integrity was appreciated by everybody. That is, everybody except those who felt threatened by him. People who were so petty-minded and shallow-minded that all they could think about was their own political ambitions. Other than that, people respected him because of his personal integrity and his honesty. He thrived during periods of great political upheaval as far as the affairs of this world are concerned. He watched the Assyrians go down the tubes. He watched the Egyptians lose their power and influence in the world. He watched the Babylonian Empire become great and then be conquered and beaten by the Persians and the Medes. And so he thrived during that period because he was faithful to God and God used him for his own purposes. He owed every success that he had to Jehovah God, to whom he was completely devoted. That's Daniel. And I think he stands as such an excellent example for us. I think there are some important lessons that I need to take home from this, and it might be beneficial for you as well. Divine providence affords opportunities from time to time. All kinds of opportunities. Opportunities to convert other peoples to Christ. Opportunities to be a good influence on people around us. Perhaps opportunities to get into a position of greater influence to where there are more people we can reach. We don't know. In 480 BC, many years later, Mordecai and his niece, whom he adopted when she became orphaned, were still part of the Persian Empire at the time. And Mordecai told Esther, "Who knows whether you have not attained royalty for such a time as this?" Some of us acquire very little influence other people in our lives. But we can influence the people that are around us. And others among us gain positions of great influence, and they have a greater scope or sphere of influence, and we need to use whatever influence we have for good. We don't know, but what we have met the people we've met and come in contact with the people with whom we've come in contact precisely so we can help those people, so we can show them the light, so that we can help them on their way with the difficulties they have in this life. We need to never compromise God's will in our lives. Never. And there are diplomatic ways that you can deal with other people. Paul talked about letting your speech be with grace, as if seasoned with salt. There, he became all things to all men, that by all means he might save some. There are approaches we can use with people. And we don't need to be antagonistic and in your face and hateful to people and say, "Well, I did my job. I told them about Jesus." You know, and we need to be diplomatic. We need to have our speech with grace, as if seasoned with salt. And yet that doesn't mean compromising our position, compromising the truth of the gospel. And we are doing no one any favors when we compromise. They need to understand what the truth of God is and understand the importance of that in their lives. Paul said in 1 Thessalonians 5:17, "Pray without ceasing." I've heard people discuss that in Bible classes, heard a lot of good comments about it. That it may have a lot of nuances to it, and I'm not trying to tear any of those down. But to simply say a prayerful attitude all the time, 24/7, I'm not sure that that's exactly what he means. But I'll tell you, Daniel is a perfect example of someone who prayed without ceasing. It was his habit to pray to God three times a day, and nobody was going to stop him from doing that. Nobody was going to get him to cease praying. Didn't matter if they threw him in a lion's den, didn't matter. He's going to keep praying to God in spite of that. Pray without ceasing. And then we need to purpose in our hearts that we're not going to defile ourselves. We need a purpose in our hearts that God is our number one and only ambition in this life, and pleasing him is our ambition and our goal. as far as this life is concerned. Make that a resolution that is rock solid in our lives, and everything else fall in line behind that. Everything else, every other decision we make in light of pleasing the one we're committed to and devoted to. We need a purpose in our heart like Daniel did, and then follow through. And then we need to have reverence for our rulers, even the bad ones. And folks, we've seen good ones and bad ones. And if we took a poll in here, not everybody would agree, be in agreement as to who the good ones are and who the bad ones are, right? And it doesn't matter. Our political views are not what join us together and give us unity and love for one another. But I'll tell you, there are people in Washington and in Frankfurt and I guess here in Murray that don't suit me. But I'll tell you, I better show reverence and respect for every one of them, not because they've earned it, but because they're in a position that demands my reverence and respect. And our society has gotten caustic on all sides. People using the foulest language and the most horrible attitudes toward elected officials and people that are in positions of responsibility above us in our government. And the kind of attitudes that you see people exhibit are not Christ-like. And if they're not Christians, you can understand it. But if somebody claims to be a Christian and you see them spewing that kind of stuff, you need to help them. It's not right. I don't think we have a single ruler that's more wicked and more vicious than Nebuchadnezzar and Darius and some of the others. I just don't believe it. We need to give them the honor that is due to them, Paul said in Romans 13 and verse 7. We need to pray for them, he told Timothy in 1 Timothy 2, 1 and 2. We need to pray for those who are in positions of authority. Why, Paul? Because I need to pray to God that they'll make the kind of decisions that'll stay out of my business. Make the kind of decisions that will allow me to live my life in peace and quiet and service to God without interference. That's what I need to be praying for. I don't care who's in Washington. As long as they do that, I'm good. As far as God's concerned, I'm devoted to God. I show everybody that's in positions of authority respect, and I pray that they'll make the right decisions that Christians can lead faithful lives to God without interference. That's what Paul said we ought to pray for. We need to learn from Daniel, have the proper attitudes of heart, and make God our number one ambition in this life. Seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness. And the things we need to be taken care of, we don't need to worry about that. Just put God first. If you're here this morning, you're not a Christian. That's what he's offering you, is the peace of mind that surpasses all understanding. People in the world can't understand it. You trust God to take away your sins because you've humbly submitted to his will. And when he takes your sins away, you even have an advocate with the Father for the future, because you're not going to do it all right, not going to be perfect. And the blood of Jesus can cleanse you from all sin, and you can be a child of God. You can have a high priest, an advocate on your behalf before the Father. And after this life is over, James said it's a puff of smoke, and when it's gone, you've got an eternity to look forward to, living with the one who created and who loves you, who wants to live with you eternally. That's what he's offering, and all we're just the messengers. We're just the recipients of the grace of God, and we want to extend that to you as well. We can help you become a Christian this morning if that's your desire. For those of us who are Christians, sometimes we allow sin to slip in our lives, and hopefully we recognize it, we go to God and ask for his forgiveness, and he is faithful and just to forgive us. If there are things on your account weighing down your soul and you're not taking care of those things with God, please do that. He is anxious for you to pray to him and sincerely repent and ask for his forgiveness, and he will forgive you. And he's created this family relationship among us to support one another, to encourage one another. And we're here for you. You can be here for us. We want to encourage you in any way that we can. If there's something we can do to help you, be sure and let us know. If you're subject to the invitation this morning, come forward and make it known while we stand together. And